This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Welcome to The New Scientist. Your reader today for New Scientist will be Paul Hinkle. Your articles will come from the newestscientist.com website. Article number one from the News Environment column. Fears grow over Antarctic ice loss. Third year of low Antarctic sea ice cover raises worries and irreversible change has happened. The sea ice that encircles Antarctica has reached near record low levels for the third year in a row, raising concern that the ice has undergone a permanent regime shift driven by climate change. This could have alarming consequences for Antarctic ecosystems and the global climate. Antarctic sea ice has long defied expectations. Modelers projecting its decline were flummoxed when sea ice cover there increased up to 2015, even as sea ice in the Arctic declined. Then ice cover fell sharply below average the following year, reaching a record low early in 2017. That started to look like a trend as the ice set another record low in 2020, then again in early 2023. Researchers were shocked when the ice failed to recover during the Antarctic winter last year, remaining so far below average that our statistical models didn't work anymore, said Edward Doddridge at the University of Tasmania in Australia. In 2024, sea ice cover has again shrunk to a near record low, reaching a minimum extent of just 1.99 million square kilometers on 20 February. The second lowest figure on record, according to the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center. Now all eyes are on winter sea ice, says Doddridge. If 2024 is like last year, there's going to be a lot of evidence suggesting that our Antarctic sea ice has changed, potentially irreversibly. Whether the persistently low sea ice represents a permanent shift driven by climate change is unclear, says Catherine Walker at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts. Is it a trend, or is it an elongated blip or a regime shift? One source of uncertainty is the short satellite record of Antarctic sea ice cover, which extends back only till 1979. That makes it hard to know the degree to which the fluctuation in sea ice is part of a natural variability in the Antarctic or response to climate change. Caroline Holmes at the British Antarctic Survey says the magnitude of the change suggests is a combination of both. Researchers also aren't sure how the atmosphere and the ocean are driving sea ice changes, an essential part of understanding why those changes are happening. Extreme temperatures and changes in wind patterns did contribute to the startlingly low sea ice levels seen last winter, says Walker. But a recent study by Doddridge and his colleagues found these changes in the atmosphere aren't sufficient to explain the changes in sea ice over the past decade. Changes in ocean temperature and salinity also drive variations in sea ice cover, but existing models can't resolve the complex interplay of these factors, says Zachary Kaufman at Stanford University in California. And there are other factors such as rapid melting of large icebergs that normally anchor the sea ice. The low level of sea ice cover may also have led to a warming feedback because open water absorbs radiation that would normally be reflected by ice. This heat memory may persist for as long as 3 years in the Southern Ocean, compounding heat, according to results Doddridge presented at the American Geophysical Union Ocean Science Meeting in Louisiana in February, where a possible regime shift was a key topic of discussion. If the ice is shifted for good, the consequences could be large. Sea ice is an essential component of many Antarctic ecosystems, says Holmes. For instance, openings in sea ice provide nutrient-rich zones that support the entire food web, from plankton to big predators. The loss of sea ice also means that the ice shelves extending out from the margins of the Antarctic ice sheet are more exposed to waves, leading to more melting and subsequent sea level rise. Shrinking sea ice could also have wider effects by altering the flow of cold water from Antarctica to the global ocean. Sea ice helps drive the circulation by generating dense water that sinks near Antarctica and adding fresh water when ice melts. Slowing that circulation down or shutting it down could have drastic effects on the climate everywhere, says Walker. Article number 2, analysis microbiology. What do home test kits really reveal about our gut microbiome? Many firms sell direct-to-consumer fecal testing kits, but it seems that they aren't supported by much evidence, says Claire Wilson. The science of our gut microbiome is often painted as one of the hottest new areas of medicine, but there have also been claims that the research is overhyped. The latest aspect of this field to come under the spotlight is testing kits that let you send away a stool sample to learn if your gut bacteria could be affecting your health. An analysis has found that claims about these kits aren't supported by evidence and the testing procedures aren't rigorous enough. Should companies even be allowed to sell them? Microbiome research took off about 20 years ago as advances in DNA sequencing let scientists find out more about the bacteria that live on and inside us. Doctors have long known that some infectious conditions are caused by an overgrowth of pathogens. The revolutionary idea was that more subtle microbiome changes could cause conditions that are usually seen as having nothing to do with our gut, such as cancer and depression. Despite the hype, the field hasn't yet transformed medicine. Fecal transplants, when stool from one person is transferred into another to boost their beneficial bacteria, have so far been licensed for just one rare medical condition, a severe form of diarrhea that typically affects hospital patients who are taking strong antibiotics. And probiotic products purported to deliver good bacteria to the gut have generally not yet been shown to work in randomized trials, the gold standard of medical evidence. But that hasn't stopped some firms from selling microbiome-related products to the public. This prompted the U.S. National Institutes of Health to set up an investigation into the public's growing use of fecal testing kits. Diane Hoffman at the University of Maryland and her colleagues identified 31 companies around the world offering direct-to-consumer microbiome analysis kits. Based on the results of these analyses, users are given reports that may give a broad indication of their gut health. For instance, in the form of a numerical score, as they may be told they have gut bacteria linked from a particular medical condition. A big problem is that the science behind fecal DNA analysis isn't yet advanced enough to produce reliable conclusions, says Hoffman. Previous research has shown that identical samples given to different laboratories can give varying results. This may be because of differences in how the sample is processed or which references databases the firms use to judge someone's microbiome. The companies generally don't give details about how they do their analyses, considering it commercially sensitive. They're not required to give out the information, says Hoffman. A further issue is that even if we could accurately quantify how much of each bacterial species someone has in their feces, there is no consensus among doctors about which bacteria are linked with specific medical conditions or a healthy gut, says Hoffman. They don't have the data necessary to say that someone's gut microbiome is healthy or unhealthy. Next article, from Health. Intermittent fasting linked to a higher risk of heart disease death. Restricting your eating window to just 8 hours a day, a popular type of intermittent fasting, has been linked to a higher risk of dying from heart disease. But some scientists argue that this may be because people with pre-existing health conditions unknowingly opt for intermittent fasting, and that what we eat is probably more important than when we eat. Time-restricted eating has previously been associated with improved blood pressure, blood glucose, and cholesterol levels, but its long-term effects are unclear. To learn more, Wenzi Zhang at the Shanghai Jiaotong University in China and his colleagues studied about 20,000 adults, roughly half men and half women, who took part in the U.S. National Health and Nutrition Examination survey. Their average age was just 49, and just under three-quarters were non-Hispanic white people. Every year from 2003 to 2018, the survey's participants self-reported dietary information. The researchers matched this against death records between 2003 to 2019. Participants were only included if they were age 20 or older and had completed two diet questionnaires in the first year of the survey. Over an average follow-up period of 8 years, the researchers found that those who ate during an 8-hour daily window didn't live longer than those with a more traditional eating schedule of 12 to 16 hours. despite intermittent fasting often being lauded for its benefits to longevity. The researchers also found that people who followed an 8-hour eating schedule were 91% more likely to die from heart disease in the follow-up period than those who ate over 12 to 16 hours. For people diagnosed with heart conditions before the study, eating during an 8 to 10-hour window was linked to a 66% higher risk of death from heart disease than it was for those who ate over 12 to 16 hours. Among people diagnosed with cancer, eating over a window of more than 16 hours was associated with a lower risk of death from the condition than a more constricted eating schedule. The study, presented this week at the American Heart Association Epidemiology and Prevention Conference in Chicago, doesn't prove that time-restricted eating caused any of these deaths, says Zong. It is important to consider the reasons for the participants' time-restricted eating, says Benjamin Horn at the Intermountain Heart Institute in Salt Lake City. Some may have done it deliberately, while others may have had limited eating windows due to health conditions or treatments affecting their appetite, he says. Some may have also had a restricted eating schedule because of limited access to food, says Joanne Carson, former chair of the AHA Nutrition Committee. Research suggests that food insecurity is associated with unhealthy lifestyles that lead to heart disease. We also don't know how healthy the foods people ate were, says Carson. The people who want to reduce their likelihood of dying prematurely should aim for an overall heart-healthy dietary pattern, regardless of the time of the day they eat, says Carson. Those who wish to start intermittent fasting should speak to their doctor beforehand, says Horn. Next article from News, Archaeology. Humans and saber-toothed cats shared a mammoth meal. A mammoth that died about 1.2 million years ago became a feast for both ancient humans and saber-toothed cats, an analysis of its bones has revealed. The fossil skeleton of this southern mammoth was excavated about 20 years ago at a site in Ors, Spain. These animals were larger than today's elephants and roamed Eurasia during the Pleistocene. The site also features stone tools suggesting the presence of an early human species, such as Homo erectus. A previous study dismissed the skeleton as having no marks made by tools or animal bites. But now Jose Yavadra at the Complutense University of Madrid in Spain and his team have re-examined it. They found marks on the ribs and pelvic bones that may be from stone tools or saber-toothed cats. To determine what caused the marks, the team recreated flint and limestone tools matching those found at the site and used them to butcher pig limbs. After using scanners to build a 3D model of the new and ancient cut marks, they trained an artificial intelligence to distinguish between cut marks and tooth marks. The results suggest that both humans and cats scavenged the meatiest parts of the carcass, but it isn't clear which species got there first or whether either killed the mammoth. The team notes that the type of tools found at the site wouldn't have been strong enough to kill an animal that large, and saber-toothed cats would only have attacked an adult mammoth if it were sick or dying. The age of this mammoth at death suggests it may have died naturally. The carcass would have weighed 3 tons, so it would have provided enough food for both species. Buildings could be 3D printed using ink made of wasted wood. Recycled wood can be turned into an ink for 3D printing, which could offer a more sustainable way to make furniture or build houses. Wood has been used for building and structural purposes for centuries, says Muhammad Rahman at Rice University in Texas. But using it isn't especially efficient because cutting wood down to size can result in lots of waste. To make use of this leftover material, Rahman and his colleagues split it into lignin and cellulose, molecules that are key to the stiff structure of wood, and broke these down to form nanofibers and nanocrystals. They then recombined the cellulose and lignin with water to make a clay-like substance that could be used as an ink. The researchers used this substance for 3D printing by forcing it through a nozzle and building up layers of ink. To boost the strength of the 3D printed objects, the team freeze-dried them to remove moisture and then heated them up to 100 degrees centigrade to make the lignin soften and fuse with the cellulose. We can actually mimic all the visual, textural, and olfactory properties of natural wood, says Rahman. The product was found to be nearly six times as durable as natural balsa wood in compression tests and up to three times as flexible in bending tests. So far, the researchers have managed to create miniature furniture and honeycomb structures using the ink, but they hope it could eventually be used to build larger objects, such as houses. We need to rethink how we can make structures without cutting down trees, says Rahman. If we can recycle waste wood using 3D printing instead of conventional manufacturing, that would be a good step forward. Next article, climate-friendly food. Should we eat snakes? Pythons convert food into meat more efficiently than any other livestock and can be fed on waste meat. But this doesn't mean eating snakes is inherently more sustainable, says Michael LePage. What kind of meat is the most sustainable? According to a study of snake farms in Thailand and Vietnam, it might be pythons. When it comes to the efficiency of converting food into meat, pythons come out on top, says Daniel Natouche at consulting firm Epic Biodiversity. No other livestock species studied to date possesses the same credentials or rates of production as pythons. Some snakes have long been farmed on a small scale for products such as venom. Only recently have they begun to be raised mainly for meat. Natouche's team measured the growth of nearly 500 reticulated and Burmese pythons over a year, along with what they were fed, plus the weight of their dressed carcasses, that is, minus the skin, internal organs, head, and tail. According to the study, the dry mass of the food the pythons were fed was 1.2 times that of the dressed carcass, compared with 1.5 for salmon, 2.1 for crickets, 2.8 for poultry, 6 for pigs, and 10 for beef. The dry mass of the protein fed to the snakes was 2.4 times that in a dressed carcass, compared with 3 for salmon, 10 for crickets, 21 for poultry, 38 for pigs, and 83 for beef. Calculating how much food is converted into meat is tricky, says Kastja Risari Salin at the Stockholm Resilience Center in Sweden. It is also important to take into account what protein animals are eating and where it comes from, she says. A key thing missing from the comparison is that snakes eat animals that ate plants, but other farm animals eat mostly plants. If the total mass of plant material required per kilogram of carcass were compared, snakes might not look so efficient. Next article, Gold Flex create a new kind of one-way window. This is from the technology column. Glare-free windows could be made from a material studded with billions of tiny metal patches. This makes a matte one-way window that reflects almost no light from outside and would allow people inside to have privacy without blurring their vision. Yun Lai at Nanjing University in China and his colleagues have created a glass-like material called a transparent matter surface, or TMS, which has a similar matte finish to frosted glass. Lai says that being matte and transparent are typically mutually exclusive properties. To achieve both, the researchers covered a wafer of the material in billions of nano-sized patches that scatter and reflect light. They made these from a reflective metal, such as gold, and materials like silicon that conduct electricity poorly, which reduces how much light they reflect. The TMS reflected as little as 1.3% of light shown onto it, but emitted enough light that a camera with the material placed over its lens could still take clear photographs. The researchers also tested the TMS on a camera connected to an AI that identifies and labels objects. The AI could successfully identify a tennis ball on the other side of the TMS. The moment they first saw the sample was fascinating, said Lai. It was difficult to imagine how a material could be clear and undistorted when light passes through it, but also have a hazy appearance when reflecting light. Simon Horsley at the University of Exeter, UK, says this material could produce quite large windows and may help cut light pollution from the reflected light. Planetary science. Blow Delta hopes that Europa's oceans are hosts of life. Jupiter's icy moon Europa may not be as ripe for life as we thought. Its underground ocean has long made it one of the most promising candidates in our solar system to host life, but theoretical studies of its sealed floor are putting a damper on its promise. On Earth, much of life in the deep ocean is supported by hydrothermal activity on the seafloor, where water interacts with rock. This provides nutrients and energy for living organisms, and researchers think that similar processes could aid life on Europa. However, these interactions require a regular supply of fresh rock that can come from faults in the rock or via volcanic activity that lets magma rise from deep underground. Research discussed at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Texas on 11 and 12 March suggests both things may be unlikely on Europa. There's been a lot of work done on the outer shell because we can see it, but we don't have much information on the seafloor, not surprisingly, because it's extremely hard to get to, says Paul Byrne at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Studies of Europa's seafloor have had to rely on theoretical calculations, simulations, and comparisons to what we see on Earth. The most dramatic way Europa's core could contribute to the habitability of its ocean is via volcanism, magma from deep underground seeping into the ocean through cracks called dikes. Austin Green at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California and his colleagues simulated this process, but the dikes weren't able to transport magma all the way from the molten areas deep in the core to its edge. They did really, 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 really bad, said Green. Our most successful one was an 11.5-kilometer dike. That one would have had to penetrate 227 kilometers of rock to spill magma onto the seafloor. If this volcanism is necessary for habitability, Europa's ocean is uninhabitable, said Green. The faults in the seafloor don't necessarily have to have magma in them to be useful, though. Every even empty fault could fuel important water-rock interactions, but Byrne and his team found that it is unlikely that any new faults are forming under Europa's sea. I don't think there's anything happening at the ocean floor, said Byrne. Another research group found that even simple erosion by sand is unlikely because the moon's low gravity means that the sediment should sit lightly on the seafloor, not providing enough weight to wear it down. Unfortunately, I'm kind of adding to the depressing news that maybe the seafloor isn't as active as maybe we thought it could be, said team member Perry Ann Johnson at the University of Texas at Austin. This doesn't mean Europa is uninhabitable, though. I think that's what's being shown here is that volcanism and habitability models that rely on the interior are starting to be less likely. But I still think that stuff coming through the ice shell from the top down is still a pretty promising avenue of research, said Green. Now, news about the solar system. A single meteorite created a billion craters on Mars. When a single meteorite struck Mars a few million years ago, it didn't just create one crater, it ultimately made billions of them. A meteorite slamming into the ground can blast a huge plume of rocks into the air. When the rocks fall back down, they create their own smaller craters, often in chains and clusters around the original impact site. This process is common on rocky bodies with thin atmospheres like Mars or the Moon, but is harder to spot on Earth, where geological activity can destroy the evidence. Matthew Golombek at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California and his colleagues used images from two spacecraft orbiting Mars to estimate the number of secondary craters created by the debris from the Corinto crater, which formed about 2.3 million years ago and is just under 14 kilometers across. They found that Corinto has between 1.3 billion and 3 billion secondaries, the most ever spotted on Mars. Each secondary was at least 10 meters across. Golombek presented this work at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Texas on 11 March. The craters cover an area of about 1.4 million square kilometers, including the area where NASA's Mars InSight spacecraft landed in 2018. The area is volcanic, and the craters pepper the surfaces of dried lava flows from Elysium Mons, one of the tallest mountains on Mars. Quantifying the number of secondaries is important to better understand how a relatively small crater could possibly eject that much material during the cratering process, says Golombek. The formation of secondaries depends on the geology of the area, as well as the properties of the impactor itself, so studying them could help us understand what Mars is made of and how various materials react to space rocks slamming into them. Animal behavior. Chimp mothers play with their young even in tough times. When there isn't much food to go around, most chimps stop playing to conserve energy, but mothers continue to frolic with their babies. Great apes such as gorillas, bonobos, and chimpanzees all have a penchant for playing, which includes tickling, poking, and chasing each other. Play helps to develop both motor and social skills, says Zarin Machanda at Tufts University, Massachusetts. It is something that babies really need to do in order to develop properly. Machanda and her colleagues recorded 3,891 bouts of play in the community of about 60 eastern chimpanzees in Kibale National Park in Uganda between 2010 and 2019. In 2016 or 2017, we had this incredible summer where there was just food everywhere at our field site, says Machanda. One of the things that we noticed was lots of adult chimps playing with each other. In times of abundance, the team recorded at least one instance of play on 97% of observation days, but this dropped to 38% when food was scarce. Mother chimps, however, kept playing with their children at even higher rates during these low availability food periods. That was really surprising, says team member Chris Sabi at Harvard University, as food is generally more important to female chimps because of the high energetic cost of reproduction. Now, in our last article from today, in zoology, city lights may have made moths evolve smaller wings. Moths trying to survive in bright cities may have evolved smaller wings to limit how much they are drawn in by the light. Artificial light shining at night disrupts the lives of many insect species, diverting them from their habitats and mates and exposing them to predators. To see if this might have caused evolutionary changes in moths, Everett van de Schoot at the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium and his colleagues analyzed the wing and body size of 680 spindle ermine moths. These moths were preserved from a previous experiment testing their responses to light. In that experiment, researchers collected moth larvae from bright urban settings and dark rural places in France and Switzerland, then raised the moths together in the same garden. In a flight-to-light test, 30% fewer urban moths were captured in a light trap than rural moths, suggesting they had a weaker response to light. Van de Schoot and his colleagues may now have an explanation for this. They found that the moths from urban settings had smaller wings on average than the moths from rural areas. Among both populations, smaller wing size was correlated with a weaker response in the light trap experiment. Having smaller wings may limit how far and fast moths go to find mates or food, but that might be beneficial in urban ecosystems if it makes the moths less susceptible to the negative effects of responding strongly to light, says van der Schoot. And that's it for New Scientist for today. Your reader has been Paul Henkel.